Welcome to News Talk, and this is D.G. Martin. So how are we going to supply the energy needs of the future? Is it going to be with oil, petroleum from the Middle East, or is it going to be natural gas from fracking in our region, or wind, or solar, or nuclear? Where are we going to get what we need? Well, maybe you remember Daniel Yergin, who wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book several years ago called The Prize, which dealt with oil. And Dr. Yergin has come back with a new book called The Quest, which goes beyond oil. It deals with the complicated supply chain for oil, but also the energy is subtitled as Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World, and how the search for energy, its allocation, and its use will be the one of the determining factors of what our world is going to be like. We're privileged to have the opportunity to visit with Dr. Yergin. First of all, welcome to Chapel Hill. We're glad to have you in town by way of telephone.
Well, thank you.
Your new book, The Quest, follows up your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Prize, and it's a more complicated at least for me, it's a little bit more complicated. I thought I could read the book and understand exactly what was going on and what was going to happen. But there are so many multiple facets to your story this time.
Right. Yeah, it's a much broader canvas.
What's the reason for that?
Well, there were two reasons. First, you know, so much had happened since I'd finished the prize, which was at the time of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. You know, there's no Soviet Union. China's become this huge factor. It wasn't at the time. No one talked about climate change. No one had heard of shale gas. Oil was going to be $20 a barrel forever, and gasoline was going to be cheap forever. And, you know, even more recently, we've had this terrible nuclear disaster in Fukushima, and the Arab Spring, which is turning into probably a decade-long period of turmoil in the Middle East. So there was much to do and write about. And at the same time, I wanted to kind of cover this whole spectrum in a very narrative, storytelling way to see how all these energy pieces fit together and kind of how we got to where we are, and where we are headed.
Wow. Well, one of the interesting commentaries that's developed from your book is the question on this peak, the peak oil question. And I bet you're having to talk about that with every person who talks to you about your book. And the question, I mean, it just seems logical that someday we're going to run out of oil. Some people have predicted like the end of the world or the second coming predicted particular dates when we'd run out of oil. Are we ever going to run out of oil?
Well, I would think so, that it is a finite resource. But I think, you know, this notion of peak oil is that we're going to very imminently run out. And that was a pretty strong sentiment. You know, last time we had a presidential election in 2008, it just seemed that kind of a very bleak future. And since then, we've seen the technology has once again opened new doors. U.S. oil production is up 25% since 2008. And there are a lot of abundant resources. They may not be cheap. They may not be easy to develop. And there may be a lot of political and military and geopolitical struggles above ground where those resources reside. But the notion that we're physically going to run out, as I say in the quest, is this is a recurrent thing that happens whenever oil prices go up. You get a much stronger feel about it, and then prices themselves lead to new areas being opened up. You know, the head of the U.S. Geological Service after World War I said there are only about 5 years' worth of oil supplies left in the United States.
Well, every time we announce that we're out of oil, we find new resources or new ways to get at existing resources. What are, and you talk about some of those in your book, some of the potential places where oil might be that we haven't gotten it yet, and with if the price of oil goes up a little bit more, it'll be worth going. What are some of those opportunities?
Well, I think there's a couple of them that are really altogether kind of changing the position of the Western Hemisphere. And I was just in China, and I was very interested to hear the Chinese talk about this new renaissance in Western Hemisphere oil. Well, if we go north to south, we start in Canada where the oil sands, which were considered just this fringe resource for a very long time, now the output of oil sands is greater than Libya's output before the Civil War there. So it's a big resource, and we're the natural market for it in the United States. The second is what's called tight oil, which is using the same technology as shale gas. And that has been quite remarkable. It's turned North Dakota into the number two oil-producing state in the country, ahead of Alaska, ahead of California, ahead of Louisiana, ahead of Oklahoma. Then you go down to Brazil, and in the middle of the last decade, they had some breakthroughs there in what's called offshore oil, what's called the pre-salt, or oil that's under this big, thick bed of salt. And it's possible that if the Brazilians stay on a good track, they could be producing considerably more oil than Venezuela by the end of this decade. And so you add all of that together, and at the same time, greater efficiency, cars that get 50 miles a gallon instead of 30, you start to see that the Western Hemisphere may not need much oil at all from the Eastern Hemisphere.
So we may not be able to have United States independence from oil, but we might be able to have Western Hemisphere independence.
Western Hemisphere, or maybe even North America, depending how things go in Canada.
Now, is that important?
Well, I think it's important for a couple of reasons. One, that doesn't jump out to people immediately. It turns out this development has a lot of sort of economic consequences from it. The shale gas, which is analogous to this tight oil, has created about 600,000 new jobs. President Obama mentioned that in his State of the Union, and then in his acceptance speech down there at the Democratic Convention. It makes our industry more competitive. It makes our electricity prices cheaper. So it really can, you know, it's a pretty bright spot in a rather bleak economic outlook right now. So there's that aspect of it. It makes us more resilient. It means there's more supplies, that the world is less vulnerable to a shock from the Middle East. The string is not drawn so taut. And I think it gives us kind of a greater sense of confidence in the world, and puts us in a position where we feel we are more resilient.
One of the parts of your book that interested me very much is your description of the giant oil companies and the things that had happened since the time that you wrote the prize in the way of consolidation, almost back to the days of John D. Rockefeller.
Right.
And could you is this important, and if so, why?
Well, I found it fascinating because it really reflected the changes in the world that these companies wanted to get larger scale to kind of manage their costs, to be more efficient, to be more diversified in terms of problems happening in the world. But it also occurred at a time when another kind of breed of oil companies was getting to be much bigger and more powerful, and it was kind of playing a dominating role in the world, and these are the state oil companies, the Saudi Aramcos, or Rosneft in Russia, or Petrobras in Brazil. And so while the traditional companies, which used to dominate the scene, have consolidated into a smaller number, although we still have lots of small companies, medium-sized, at the same time, you've had the rise of these companies that are, you know, owned partly or completely by governments and are intimately tied to the resource position of those countries.
The oil plays an important, as I learned in your book, plays an important part in the political structure and social structure of the oil-producing countries. And
oh, yeah. I mean, you look at Russia, over half of its budget comes from oil and gas earnings. You look at Iran, until these sanctions, over half of its budget from oil and gas. You look at other countries, it's even higher than that, and you realize their social system, their social fabric is lubricated by oil.
You used Nigeria as an illustration of where an abundance of oil has not been totally a positive factor for the country. And what is the difference between countries that are able to use these natural resources for positive development and those for whom it just seems to pull the country down?
Well, that's a profound question that is much debated, about whether the oil curse or the resource curse or Dutch disease, whether, you know, would these countries be better off without it? You know, you can look at a country like Singapore that has zero resources except for the brains of its people, and it's a very successful country with a very high standard of living. I think, you know, I think it's, you know, Nigeria is a very big country. I think one out of seven Africans is a Nigerian, with many different ethnic groups and religious groups. And so there's a huge battle that occurs over what is done with the revenues. Big problem with corruption, big problem between the regions and the national government, and a lot of opportunity for people to, you know, get rich, to capture the resource. And if you have a weakish government, you don't have a rule of law, you don't have the kind of governmental institutions, then society is very vulnerable to that. But it's interesting because, you know, the violence in, until recently has really been concentrated in that oil region, the Delta. And I have that incredible photograph in the book of those guys with guns on a boat in the swamp. It's a pretty scary picture. But now, of course, the violence has really shifted to the north, where you have some very, you know, militant jihadist al-Qaeda type people who are kind of wantonly declaring religious war, and that's not so much connected to oil, unlike the problems east.
We're talking with Daniel B. Yergin, the author of The Quest, Energy Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Daniel Yergin, author of The Quest, Energy Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. Well, let me shift gears just a little bit. And I thought one of the great sections of your book is for modern history was the role that oil played in the breakup of the Soviet Union and in the, I guess you could say, the reinvigoration of its economy and social life and politics, as somebody figured out how to marshal those resources first as a private enterprise and then back in under Soviet control. Under Russian control. It's very complicated, isn't it?
It's complicated, but it's a great story with great personalities, and you know.
Can you just give us? I mean, you got to read the book to get the whole thing, but can you give us a summary of that?
Sure. Well, what happened, of course, one of the reasons the Soviet Union collapsed was because oil prices collapsed. And it was the Soviet Union was really depending upon oil revenues to kind of keep it afloat. You know, they ran short of bread, so the premier would say, can you produce more oil so we can buy, you know, wheat from the West? Obviously, the Soviet Union basically collapsed because the system was rotten. It wasn't working. But in its last decade or so, decade and a half, oil kept it afloat. And maybe even, you know, I remember talking to former prime minister of Russia, and he said that Soviet Union would have collapsed earlier had oil prices not gone up in 1973, and then the death knell came in 1986. Well, once that happened, you had two things. One, you had all these newly independent states that had never really been independent countries before in a modern sense, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, and so forth, and they set out, they had oil resources. And they set out to get them developed, and to get them developed to really consolidate their independence. So one of the biggest battles was to get the oil, you know, these are the Central Asian Caspian states that people had not heard of before, was how to get the oil out there without having to go through Russia, because otherwise it was feared Russia would just kind of reconsolidate them back into a new Soviet Union. And so I tell the story of this big battle over this pipeline that was just went on for a decade, and finally they built it, and it runs this 1,100 miles from the Caspian Sea. People would have to look at a map through Azerbaijan, through Georgia, down through Turkey to the Mediterranean and Kazakhstan. You know, these are big oil producing states now, and so they've used that to consolidate. And I tell the story of the pipeline that never was, which was the pipeline that was going to go from another one of these countries called Turkmenistan, which has a lot of gas and a very authoritarian political system, down through Afghanistan, down to India and Pakistan. And that project was sort of moving along. And then after the attacks on our embassies in East Africa in 1998, that was the end of it, because it was clear that Afghanistan was moving under the control in alliance with al-Qaeda. But then there's the story of Russia itself, which was, here was a, you know, the Prime Minister of Russia said it was, when they took over, it was like going into the cockpit of a jet and finding no one in control. And, you know, the economy was just headed down. And you had the kind of wild East years of Yeltsin, in which you had the emergence of these private oil companies. Because remember, the Soviet Union had been the world's largest oil producer. And so you had the emergence of these private companies.
How did, Daniel Juergen, forgive me for interrupting you, but how did the, at the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union, how did the government oil producing companies or arrangements, how did they happen to fall into private hands and make, you know, a whole generation of Russian young men?
Oligarchs, yeah. They became known. Well, what happened is that, you know, it had been a ministries that had actually produced it. And then ministries sort of disappeared, and so you had these regional production associations, basically, and that was the battle to get control of them. And Mr. Yeltsin, who was, the first Russian president, instituted what called privatization. And so you had these very, guys, right time, right place, who kind of saw the opportunity, were not living in a communist past, and figured out how to gain control of the shares of these companies. Partly, one of them was a deal that Yeltsin government desperately needed money during the 1996 election because it looked like the communists were going to win. And so they had this famous loan for shares deals in which these guys made loans to the governments, got the shares, and then the government never paid back the loans, so they owned these oil companies. And so suddenly you started to see the emergence of Russian private oil companies. And these were really immense companies that each of them had the production capacity of an Exxon Mobil or a Royal Dutch Shell. So really big companies.
How does that stand now in Russia?
Well, what happened, Mr. Putin, I wrote about this. And I went back and read what he wrote when he was actually getting his PhD after he was working for the mayor in St. Petersburg, lost his job when the mayor was defeated and kind of unemployed, and went back to school and wrote a PhD saying that oil and gas would be the basis of the rebirth of modern Russia. And when he came in, he told the oligarchs, you stay out of politics, I'll stay out of business. But that bargain fell apart, and really the oil interests of Russia have been, there's still big private companies there, but the dominant companies now are the state companies. And I was at a meeting with Mr. Putin in June in St. Petersburg at an economic forum, and his detailed knowledge of the oil and gas sector of Russia and global markets is very impressive. You don't expect to see a head of state who is almost like a hands-on CEO.
We're visiting with Daniel Juergen, author of The Quest, Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Daniel Juergen, who is the author of The Quest, Energy, Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. Well, I could talk about the Russian challenges for a long time, but there are other places where the energy and oil will have an impact on our life, and that, moving over to China, you tell the wonderful story of how China moved from being an exporter of a little bit of oil to is going to be the largest consumer of petroleum on the planet. How did that work?
Well, that's all, all goes back to Deng Xiaoping, who, had been a loyal lieutenant of Mao and then had been purged during the Cultural Revolution and spent those years sort of in isolation asking what went wrong. And so when he came to power, the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, he started this process of economic reform. And China had a fairly large oil industry, but it was mostly for domestic. He pushed it to export oil so that they could get the money they needed to start the first phase of rebuilding China. But then there came that dramatic moment, big shock in 1993, when China went from being an exporter to an importer as it became more integrated in the world economy. And today, you know, just a few years ago, China just overtook Japan as the world's second largest oil consumer. Now it consumes twice as much oil as Japan, second only to the United States. Its overall energy consumption is larger than the United States, second largest importer of oil. And so there's a deep preoccupation with oil and energy in China. I just spent last week in China publishing the Chinese edition of the
Oh, well.
And I'll tell you, they're so, in, you know, pay such close attention to global development, and they pay close attention to what's happening in the United States in terms of energy.
Well, breaking away from the book for just a minute, and you've been in China, and, you know, I mean, what your book proves is that you're always going to be learning something new about energy. What did you learn in China that you didn't know before?
Well, I learned that they're really, you know, we have this shale gas development in the United States. They're really interested in shale gas. They think they have resources that may be larger than the United States, but more difficult to develop, and they don't have the skill set yet on a large scale. And secondly, they're really watching our shale gas development because they see the United States now having low-cost energy, and that's an offset to low-cost labor in China. And they think the United States is going to be more competitive as a manufacturer in the world economy, and that's not something they'd expect it to see.
Well, this is really interesting to me, and I'd never thought of it before, other than to see some of the sophisticated high-energy using factories online. But the idea that the Chinese are worried about is because we can get relatively inexpensive power here for our plants, and that the more manufacturing is done by robots and big machines, the United States will have a competitive advantage over the Chinese. Is that, I mean, that's kind of...
it's not what we've believed. It's not kind of what you hear all the debate in the presidential campaign, you know, that's kind of going over there. But that this is what they're looking at, that, you know, the rest of the world thinks the U.S. is gaining because of this kind of renaissance of domestic oil and gas, that this enhances the economic strength of the United States, even in these difficult economic times.
Getting back to the Chinese problems, where will the China, if we're talking about petroleum or natural gas, I guess, as well, where are the Chinese going to get their resources for relatively inexpensive energy?
Well, I'm not sure they necessarily expect it to be inexpensive, but, you know, I describe in the quest, they're clearly active in the Middle East. They're very active in Africa, in both East Africa and West Africa. They get more oil through the Persian Gulf now than we do, coming out of the Strait of Hormuz. But they've also made a big effort to diversify, to get oil from those same Central Asian countries we were talking about before, like Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. They're getting oil from Russia. They're having an argument about natural gas, what the price should be. They're getting natural gas from Australia, and they are interested in getting resources also from North America. So one of the Chinese oil companies has just made a bid for one of the medium-sized, one of the larger Canadian oil companies, and the Chinese have said that they'll set up their international operations in Calgary.
If the competitive battle for dominance in industry is going to be on inexpensive energy, as you mentioned that you talked about in China, then are we bound to have conflict with the Chinese as we try to marshal the inexpensive sources of energy and they are trying to do the same thing?
DG, I think you've pointed to one of the really key issues that's going to take sort of wise management by the U.S. and indeed by the Chinese, that it would be easy to slip into a situation where feel there's a competition for supplies. And a few years ago, that seemed strong, and it's still there in terms of the Chinese flexing their muscles in the South China Sea, which is thought to have a lot of resources beneath those waters.
So the conflict over the between the Japanese and the Chinese is not just for a couple of rocks. It's for
no, it's there too in East China that it's thought it's the resources there. But it's so easy, you can see, in both countries for nationalism to get inflamed. You know, and we kind of see this in this presidential campaign, the stirring up of, you know, the Chinese who's more anti-Chinese. But in fact, we have common interests as importers, as consumers, as countries that have a common interest in the stability of the world oil market. So, and you know, we are, as we've seen, very interdependent. In the financial crisis that began in 2008, the country that got started us on recovery and pulling out was a stimulus program in China before our own got going. And so we're, you know, so I think it's just, it would be unwise to go down a path where it feels like we're in a collision with the Chinese over resources rather than seeing how the world really operates, which is that actually companies go out in the world and they operate often in partnerships because the risks are so great. So, you know, the Chinese companies are partners with Western companies now in Iraq, for instance.
We're visiting with Daniel Yergin, author of The Quest, Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. We're talking with Daniel Yergin. Dr. Yergin is the renowned author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Prize, and we're talking about his new book, The Quest, Energy Security and the Remaking of the Modern World. I want to move away from oil, but I can't leave the opportunity to talk to you without asking you to tell us a little bit about Hugo Chavez down in Venezuela, who is a character who just intrigues me. Is he crazy? I mean, is he a genius?
I think he's a political genius. This is a man, Hugo Chavez, who kind of was raised and very influenced by a communist teacher. Went to the military academy in Venezuela. Started with Carry Che Guevara's diaries with him when he went there, and he went with the notion that he would, you know, with great megalomaniacal dreams that he would be the leader of Venezuela. So he organized a coup in the early 1990s. It failed, but he went on television and told the other troops to put their arms down, but said, "We will return." He went to jail. He was a celebrity in jail. People would come to visit him. And he came out and he ran for president and, against kind of discredited political parties and won. And then the question became, you know, what's his orientation? Well, his orientation is that he sees himself as a kind of the political son of Fidel Castro. And, so he has tightened the grip on Venezuela, brought what democracy there to an end. And is using the oil to advance political objectives, which is kind of socialism for the 21st century and kind of a revolutionary creed. He is ill. He has cancer. So he's gone several times to Cuba for medical treatment. He's actually up for re-election now. People weren't sure he'd survive, but he has survived. And, however long he lives, he'll be president for life.
Well, Venezuela's had a lot of oil for a long time, and is it going to be a major supplier down the line?
It is a major supplier, but it has declined since Chavez has taken power because he's diverting money from investment in the industry to other things. He's nationalized companies, thrown people out. So we import a fair, Venezuela is one of our significant sources of oil, not as big as it used to be, but he's keen to build a pipeline to the Pacific through Colombia so he can export to China.
if you were counseling our government about policy towards South America and Cuba and specifically Venezuela, is the best thing to do just sort of to wait them out? Or are there things that the United States ought to be doing?
Well, I think it's important to not to underestimate him and what his objectives are and his ability to use his oil money to further political objectives in other countries. And to, there's no point having direct confrontation. We're limited. You know, he has a lot of Cuban advisors in the country who have helped him create a security system that kind of parallels a kind of block political control that they have in Cuba. So I think he's, now we'll have to see what happens with his health and how long he hangs in there. Obviously, his idol, Fidel Castro, has kind of outlived everybody.
Yeah, that's right. The conversations about oil are fascinating to me, but I have to say that the thing that grabbed me about your new book, The Quest, is the incredibly complex and in many cases hopeful, other cases a little cautionary, discussion of the development of other reasonably available or now or in the future of energy that's going to play a role. And so you've got everything from the natural gas and the fracking controversy that we've got down here in the Carolinas to wind power, to solar, to the remaining role for atomic energy, for wind power, a whole bunch of things that you catalog and discuss. And is it just too complicated to understand now where we're going to...
No, I don't think so. The way I tried to do it is to do it as narratives to explain how things developed and to find these great characters, everything from obscure chemistry professors that no one has ever heard of to, Ronald Reagan when he was an actor,
kind of
go through this story here. I think natural gas is going to play a bigger role in the future of our country. And, a lot of debate about shale gas and fracking. The fact is that shale gas is about 40% of our gas supply now. It was 2% a decade ago, so it's had a huge impact. I think wind and solar have made a lot of progress. Wind more than solar. Wind is about 4% of our electricity today. Solar is only about, despite all the attention it gets, it's only about 0.1%.
Wow.
So there's a real, we put wind and solar together, but they're different. And I'm also encouraged because there's so much effort going into innovation and research all across the energy spectrum at a level we've never seen before. And that may not give us answers for tomorrow, but it will give us answers for 20 years from now.
Well, what are some of the stories that grabbed you the most in terms of these alternative, or alternative isn't the right word, the different places
well, I think,
to go for energy?
One question is, where did wind come from? And as a modern technology, obviously Don Quixote, tilting at windmills, that's been, it's not new. But, and I found a guy who was probably the father of the modern wind industry in the United States, and got his story about how he'd gotten into this and how difficult it was, and then he ended up trying to get it. His wind turbines kept falling down, and he started bringing wind turbines in from Denmark, and that's kind of what got the wind industry going in California. And just, a great, gritty entrepreneur who didn't give up. There are a lot of people in the book who just didn't give up, no matter what they're working on. Where did solar energy come from? Well, it goes back to Albert Einstein finally getting a job in the patent office in Switzerland and writing a paper that gets a Nobel Prize in 1905 about the photoelectric effect. And, here we are in 2012, still building a solar industry, although the costs are coming down. I found a great story of the leading solar energy entrepreneur in China who had emigrated to Australia and never thought he was going to go back to China, and went back and, you know, in a few years built this biggest solar company in the world. And, you know, in a country that is hungry for all sorts of energy. So there, you know, and then there are the politicians and the statesmen and, you know, and the wheeler dealers. So it's a great gallery of characters. And Hyman Rickover, who's, was interesting because, you know, young people I know, I mentioned Hyman Rickover and they look blankly at me. But older people know he's the father of the nuclear navy. What they don't know, he's also the father of nuclear power.
Yeah. Well, you know, while you, Daniel Yergin, while you're talking about Rickover and his Lieutenant Jimmy Carter, we really don't know where we stand at the time. About the time, right before your book came out last year, the Japanese experienced this great, disruptive tragedy that shook the world with the earthquake and the tsunami that put its nuclear business, I guess, now out of business. But at the same time, we're reliant on nuclear production. You point out in your book something that I didn't know before, and that is that during the period where there were no new atomic energy plants, nuclear plants built, the production of nuclear energy increased astronomically because people learned how to run those plants.
Exactly that. It's almost as though we've doubled our nuclear fleet without actually doubling it by going from plants that operate at 58% capacity to plants that operate, 94% of the time. Huge difference. And it came from, people really being much more disciplined, understanding the technology, and a lot of people who had worked and been trained by Rickover and gone through that selection process where he put them in chairs with one leg cut short to put them at a disadvantage, gone through that very rigorous program, emerging as the people who were really running civilian nuclear power as well.
Where does that leave us in terms of the future? We've got highly trained people who now know how to run these plants. I assume know how to build them, but a lot of us have a great fear of the catastrophic damage that can occur if something goes wrong, as at Chernobyl and with the Japanese experience.
I think in this country we have, a couple of projects that are going forward in Georgia and South Carolina. But I think just the economics of nuclear are tough when you can use natural gas, cheap natural gas. Germany said no. Japan has more or less said no. But other, on the other hand, China is going gung-ho on nuclear power. They're building nuclear power plant, 4 reactors in, of all places, Abu Dhabi in the Middle East, because electricity is a big problem. But certainly the great kind of notion of a nuclear renaissance of 2 years ago.
Well, we've been talking to Dr. Daniel Yergin, who was the author of the prize, Pulitzer Prize-winning book about oil, and he's been talking to us about his new book, The Quest, Energy, Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. Thanks to him. Thanks to you for listening. This has been D.G. Martin, and Who's Talking will be back here before you know it.